Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Over the course of 125 years, some 13,500 children grew up part or much of their life, for some of them, in the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. Ed Lentz, local historian Ed Lentz, and sometimes host of All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Occasional host.
Sometimes, and right when we need him most, has written a book about the home. It's called A Home of Their Own, the story of Ohio's greatest orphanage. Ed, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Later on, we're going to have a couple of former residents of the home join us, and then also we're going to have a discussion with a proponent of returning to the orphanage movement in the last segment. So hopefully you'll stay tuned for that and join that conversation as well. Ed, where did the idea, to give us a little backdrop on where the idea for a home for the soldiers and sailors orphans came from?
It came out of the transformational conflict of American life, the American Civil War. We're coming up on the sesquicentennial of the American Civil War, so we'll be hearing a lot more about it over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. It's difficult today for some people to understand just how catastrophic that war was. Let me just give you a little example of that. A nation of 30 million people. At the end of that war, 600,000 men were dead and another 500,000 really badly wounded. If we fought that war today in a nation of 300 million people, we'd have 6 million people dead and another 5 million wounded. This country had never really approached a problem like that. What do you do to help those people who had been wounded and survived? As Lincoln said, how do we help the widow and the children who are essentially the innocent victims of this conflict? So coming out of the American Civil War, we're going to get a movement on the part of the national government to really set up veterans' benefits in their modern form for the first time. And any number of states are going to try to cope with the problem of now we have veterans who basically have nowhere to go, so we're going to need veterans' homes, like the soldiers' home down in Dayton, the Ohio Veterans Home up in Sandusky. And we're also going to be setting up, not just in Ohio, but across the country, a series of orphanages to help the children who have been left by this conflict. In Ohio, as well as some other states, that movement was spearheaded by probably one of the most powerful political organizations of its time, the Grand Army of the Republic, the Union Army Veterans Organization, which largely got its power from lobbying for those kinds of benefits, both for veterans on the one hand and for the children and widows of them on the other. And that's how the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home really began, as an orphanage created by the Grand Army of the Republic, which then, in very short order, was transformed into a state institution, receiving state support as well. And this was the same thing that was happening across most of the East and Midwest, with most states had a Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. The difference is Ohio's was extraordinarily successful, lasted a very long time, well into the 20th century. Some of the other states, that wasn't the case. After 10, 20, 30 years, as that Civil War generation of children passed on, some of those orphanages didn't survive.
Their mission had ended.
Right. But others stayed. And Ohio wasn't alone, but I would submit to you that Ohio was probably one of the most successful, if not the most successful, of these kinds of orphanages.
I imagine, as a historian, writing a book like this, you know, it spans such an amazing segment of American history. It kind of tells the story through the prism of the orphanage itself, because there's ups and downs and all arounds all the way up until when it closed in the, well, technically in the mid-90s, I guess, sometime.
Right.
Why was the home considered, or why is the home now considered so successful?
Because it made the transition, I think, very well from being just simply something that was trying to deal with an immediate difficult problem, all of these children of Civil War veterans who had no place else to go. We almost had to come up with a way to, how do we create a self-contained community for these people that is more than just a place to stay and sleep and get by? And so the home creates a phenomenal educational training system, which is both academic as well as vocational education on the side. It is a complete social and cultural community along the way as well. And it demonstrates that if you have people who are committed to providing the best, and if you have resources committed to providing the best, you can come up with an immensely successful institution. And that's basically what we try to show in this book. It's a fascinating story because, again, as a state agency, it's going to be subject, as most state agencies are, not only in Ohio but across the country, to the whim of politics. Mm-hmm. And as administrations change from time to time, you can see it almost like clockwork. So too does the administration change at the home from time to time. One of the most fascinating things about this story is how the institution is able to maintain its continuity, maintain its heritage, and keep moving forward even as the political winds shift along the way from time to time as well. It's going to confront other problems as well along the way, just trying to come to grips with changes in American society, how
right.
we look at ourselves, that kind of thing.
It was whoever and however they managed to maintain the continuity, it was in many ways a very visionary institution. Long before, by the time they started to come around with standards, I was at in the 30s or the 40s when they started to create standards at the state level for what they should be doing, they were already doing it.
Right.
Racial integration, it wasn't fully integrated. There were segregated housing for African Americans early on. Of course, I'm sure that changed over time, but even still, the kids who did live there wrote and have talked about how, yeah, there was segregation, but once you were in the classroom, once you were on the ball field, every other way, it was completely integrated.
Well, I think it's important to understand.
Early on,
it's important to understand the way they looked at this institution. It wasn't just that we were helping out a lot of kids who happened to need some help. This institution was founded as a matter of right. In other words, the sons and daughters of the veterans deserved this institution. This is what the state...
They were the honorees of the institution.
This is what the state owed these mm-hmm. children. It just simply wasn't something nice we were doing for them on the side.
And that's really critical,
social,
though.
Social
they weren't considered a burden on society, per se,
right.
Or that someone wasn't doing their right. job and can't take care of their own kids.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to basically try then to construct an institution that does them justice. That's the idea behind the institution, and it works real well.
614-292-8513. That's the number you can call if you want to speak with Ed Lentz or comment about his new book, A Home of Their Own, the story of Ohio's greatest orphanage. It was originally called the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. It opened its doors in 18, exactly.
Right after the Civil War.
Right after the Civil War, it survived for 125 years.
And it was down at beautiful downtown Xenia, Ohio, garden spot of Southwest Ohio. And it opened originally when the GAR ran it in the middle of downtown Xenia, right next door to the county courthouse.
But not for long. They realized.
Within a year, they had acquired this large estate on a site out just south of the town called Poverty Knoll, where they built the institution, and they've been in Xenia ever since. And in fact, we should mention in passing, the buildings are still there. I mean, when the institution closed, it transitioned over to a new institution now being run by an outfit called Legacy Ministries, which runs a variety of different institutions out of there. But if you drive onto that campus, you can get a really good idea to this day of what it looked like at the time, because most of the buildings are still there.
It was built to last. They were beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
There was a military feel to how
right.
the school operated,
right.
obviously. A lot of pageantry.
Right. It was set up basically as a military sort of approach because of its origins. And it stayed that way, I would say, probably down through most of the 19th century. It's not going to be until the early 20th century that you begin to see a transition away from the dominant military, where everybody's wearing uniforms every single minute of the day and that sort of thing. But there is a long military heritage and tradition at the school, with military drill and military activities all the way through its entire history, all the way down until the time it closes.
You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to join the conversation on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tell us about the demise of the school. What happened? What brought about the big changes?
Well, the organization changes over the 20th century. And by the time you get down to the years after World War II, you'll see a transition after 1978 into the Ohio Veterans Children's Home. Essentially, what all ends up happening is you have fewer and fewer people at the home, and it becomes more and more of a treatment center and less of a traditional children's home. And when we get down to the 1990s, there are relatively few children left in the institution. The cost per child is rising because of the fixed costs of the organization. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what eventually will lead to the demise of the home. There is a movement within the 20th century and a continuing conversation, which this book addresses as well, which is with us still in this community, in any community, about orphanages on the one hand compared to foster care as an alternative for children in need on the other. And the dominant theme in much of American social work in the 20th century becomes basically looking at foster care in lieu of orphanages along the way. One of these points that this book is trying to make is that orphanages properly conducted in their time and in our time meet a need, fill a niche, and still have a place in this society. Basically, that point of view gets sort of lost in the shuffle in the years after World War II, and you begin to see less and less support and concern for the orphanages that remain in America. But if you look at the really successful ones, and this is not the only one. There's mm-hmm. still a few still left running around the country. Properly conducted, properly financed, and staffed with committed people, they work really, really well.
One of the aspects of it that resonated with me in reading the essays by the former residents mm-hmm. of the home was that sense of permanence. Mm-hmm. And so much of the system of social work as it surrounds children's services, is about getting them back somewhere, not keeping them somewhere permanently. And when you talk about the conversation about orphanages today and bringing them back today, is it bringing them back in the same way that this home operated in a permanent way?
For some kids in our society, a structured institutional environment for a considerable length of time makes a lot of sense. I mean, we still find people today who are given advice when they're 10 or 12 or 14 years old, son, what you need is 6 years in the Army. Mm-hmm. It'll make a person out of you. And don't make it just 2 years in the Army. Make sure you stay in for six so it does the job right, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It isn't just that, however. I mean, we've known for years that basically institutions like the home, like treatment facilities for persons, some people fit into a blind school better than others. Some people who have the need fit into a deaf school, like we have in this state, mm-hmm. better than
others. It's an option, in other words.
It's an institutional option which works and is needed in this society.
Okay, we have to take a break. When we return, Ed Lentz will still be with us, along with two former pupils of the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. There's a conversation going on there as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News, and at 1 o'clock On Point, we'll be here. Politicians say they can cut taxes and cut the deficit. Ronald Reagan's budget director David Stockman now says that's a big lie. On Point hears him out. That discussion at 1 on Point right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts. Breast cancer survivor and author of The Middle Place and Lift, Kelly Corrigan, will share her experiences Thursday, September 30th at the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org.
58 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 73. A few clouds tonight, a low of 48. Sunshine tomorrow and a high of 65. And some sunshine for the weekend, but a chilly weekend with highs in the upper 50s. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Let's hear a familiar song from the home, the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. It was a seasonal song, but very familiar.
Wish you Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas all. May the richest blessings ever on you fall. Every year be brighter than the one before. And your Christmas mornings many, many more.
That is the choir of the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Home, and it is their official Christmas carol. I know that one of my guests in the studio was sort of humming or lip-syncing along with it. It's Bob Impson. He's a former pupil from the home. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And joining us from Tombstone, Arizona is Morrison Gilbert, ever after known on the show as Maury. Welcome to the show, Maury.
The song gave me goosebumps.
I know. It gave me goosebumps because you hear those voices from long ago. And when you know that they were orphans at this home, it has a whole different feel to it than just, you know, your average school choir kind of a thing.
Right.
Christmas was a very, very big deal in the home. Can you tell me a little bit? First of all, I should say, Bob, you graduated or left the home in 1941.
Yes, ma'am.
And Maury, you were the class of 1956.
Yes, ma'am.
Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you ended up there and, you know, how long you were there?
Okay. I was born in Urbana, Ohio. There were five Impson children. There was one young mother. My father became deceased in early 1929. I was sent to the Urbana County Children's Home, where I resided only for a few months until I was eligible and admitted to the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. And on August the 10th, 1929, at the age of six, my older brother and a sister were transported from Urbana to the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home on August the 10th. And we eventually stayed there 11 and 12 years each. I had a younger sister who was only 2 months old when my father passed away as a result of World War I. And Mary Kay was not eligible to come to the home until she was 4 years old. So she stayed with my mother and the Urbana Children's Home until she was four, and then she was transferred to the home along with a younger brother. So eventually all five Impson children ended up as members of the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home.
Do you remember when you first arrived?
Yes, ma'am.
What do you remember the most?
I was 6 years old, and I remember the drive from Urbana down to Xenia, not knowing what the future held for us. The most memorable thing that I remember on August the 10th was it had rained a little bit in the morning. But as we went down Home Avenue, my older brother was sitting on the right side in the back seat, and I was sitting on the left side in the back seat, and my sister Willetta was sitting between the two of us, and she had fallen asleep. And as we turned into the entrance of the children's home, I had never seen anything so huge or great or welcoming in my life. On the right at the top of the hill was what I later learned was Collier Chapel, which was built in 1874. And as we wound up the hill to what used to be Poverty Ridge, And now was the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. We sat in the car for about an hour until the paperwork evidently was done. Then we were transferred to the hospital. The home had its own hospital. And they had two isolation wards for new kids. And so the two boys were placed in one isolation ward of the hospital, and my sister was in the other. And for the next 2 weeks, we went through the medical exams and physical exams and psychological exams, and we got checked for head lice, and we got immunization shots. And for the first 2 weeks, we lived in basically isolation with other kids called Nukies. And at the end of the 2 weeks, my brother and I were assigned to Cottage 18, and that was on the main campus. And the children and all the boys in Cottage 18 were from age 4 up to age 17. And I was 6, and so my life on the campus began. And I've often said, when I talk about the home, that our Heavenly Father, I think, handpicked Poverty Ridge for an orphanage because there were more trees to climb, and there was a lake to fish in and swim in. There were 972 youngsters there at the time, and although we had very little left of a family, we had a big family. There were 972 of us, and we were all family.
Ed Lentz, during that time when the kids would be in the hospital, what were they looking for? What were they screening for? What might have disqualified a child from becoming part of that big family?
Well, what might have led to further isolation was communicable disease.
Sure.
One of the things that happens through much of the 19th century, not just in institutions, but in America's cities as well, are rampant epidemics. A diphtheria epidemic at the home took the lives of several children along the way.
13.
The important point with this is, and I think it's worth mentioning in passing, actually the children going through the home probably have better health care, better dental care, better vision care than many or most of the kids their own age through much of the rest of society. The health care facilities at the home are essentially first class from the time the home is established. It is a remarkable system. And what it's really designed to do on the initial entry is to find out if the child has anything communicable and then to treat it appropriately one way or the other. But you're going to keep the child there. It's just a question of finding out whether you got a problem that you need to deal with and learn about it head on.
And before it spreads and
before
that kind
it spreads
of
and that sort of thing. Yeah.
And there was a point in the book when I was reading that said that actually the home, the residents of the home survived much better during different pandemics and that kind of a thing than the general population did.
Right.
Probably because of the isolation to a certain
degree. Isolation.
Right. Maury, tell us about you came along in the next generation of kids. You left in 1956. Tell us about your a little bit about your story and what you remember from the beginning.
Well, we were from Stanley Avenue in North Dayton, kind of poor, lived in a World War II Army trailer without running water. My older sister and my younger brother and I went into the home on December 4th, 1947. My sister graduated in 53 and I graduated in 56. And my younger brother graduated in 59. And my story is not much different than Bob's, except I was really impressed with the hospital when we went in there. And I can, after our 2 weeks stay, my sister was assigned to the main campus, one of the girls' cottages, and Johnny was assigned to Pan 3, and I was assigned to Pan 2, I believe. That's when they had Peter Pan cottages for the kids that were not ready for the main campus yet.
Yeah, I love the name Peter Pan.
Yeah.
614-292-8513. And James, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was calling because I had some connection with some of the boys in the home in the 1950s. when I was a Boy Scout and would go to Camp Birch, which is not very far from Xenia. It's in the same county, Greene County. And my memory was that there would be boys from the orphanage often at Camp Birch. And the recollection I have is the very good comments which these boys would make about the home. And the other thing that impressed me as a boy, and still does to this day, that they would seem to have about the same amount of money as the rest of us would have, so that they could take part in buying things that were available for sale and live quite a normal life. And it just seemed to me from that point forward that the home had provided very well for these young boys.
Maury, Bob, did either of you go to the Boy Scout camp?
Yes.
Yes.
We call our camp Camp Cooper. It was located on a little Miami River. And all during the summer, groups from the home were sent to the camp. For most of them didn't get vacations, and that was their vacation. We had a mess hall there and tents, and it was a summer lark. But I disagree. We didn't have much money to buy all those.
But we did get an allowance.
Yes. Oh, the allowances are another story, but yes, we did. When we were 18, we got an allowance of 50 cents a month. But there was no need for money, really, because everything was so provided on the campus. Later on, my wife and I became house parents of Pan 1. Peter Pan was not built until 1932. And I was in college then, and my wife and I were the house parents for Pan 1. And I remember those youngsters that were 8 years old got 10 cents a month allowance. And they walked many in good weather downtown to the First Presbyterian Church because Collier Chapel would not hold all of them, all of the children at the home. And my wife issued each child from his allowance envelope each Sunday morning 2 cents to put in the collection plate. And it didn't take a mathematician to find out that there are a couple of months in the year that have 5 weeks in them. And so there were some months, yes, we got the children in Pan 1 got an allowance of 10 cents, went into the envelope. And
oh, I think I lost him.
Okay. Are you there, Maury?
I'm here.
Okay.
Yep.
It went into the envelope.
Go ahead. Should I go ahead?
Go ahead.
And there were some months.
We're hanging on tenterhooks right now.
There were some months a child ended up with nothing in his allowance plate. Okay. But Camp Cooper was a great part of our summer life at the home. Boy Scouts went at one time, Girl Scouts went at another time. And it interested me later on in my life when I was in educational administration. It seemed like our football team that was always so successful always went to camp the last month of summer before football practice started. And so they were all in pretty good shape at that time.
James, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the show. Let's talk a little bit about the holidays. Christmas was a very special time. I was very touched by the decorations everywhere, Christmas trees everywhere. Maury, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yes, it was a very special time. I remember my first Christmas. My former classmates from Van Cleve Elementary School sent a huge box of all sorts of toys, and it was really my first big Christmas. And I had so many toys in that box, I just couldn't believe it. So we shared it with my supervisor and I shared it with all the other kids. We just had everything. But Christmas was very, extremely special. I mean, it was just a neat, neat time of the year.
Bob, what about you? What do you remember about Christmas?
I remember that when I was 14 or 15 years old, each child in the home was allowed an amount of money and a certificate to take to Xenia to buy his Christmas present.
Could you lean forward a little closer to the mic so folks can hear you?
And if you take $5 and you have a brother and a sister and later on a girlfriend, you spread it out as best you can. But I think the Christmas carol and the Christmas morning breakfast was one of the things that I shall always remember about this day in the OS&SO home.
Maury, we're running out of time for this segment, but I wanted to make sure, when you look back over those years, what is the enduring memory? What is the thing that, or is it just a million memories?
Lots of memories. Particularly, I just love the athletics. We had a really, really good basketball team in 1956. We made the regional playoffs with 16 teams left in Ohio. Speaking of the health services, I was really buck-tooth when I went in the home, and Dr. Shuler said, well, I can fix that. So he put braces on my teeth and straightened my teeth out. I'm forever grateful for that. I was subjected to discipline that I never had before. Had role models, had an academic program that I really didn't put out much, but I got a lot more out of it than I put into it, I think. Mm-hmm. And I have very, very few regrets. I regret getting caught sneaking out at night.
You only regret getting caught, though.
Yeah, getting caught sneaking out. You always got detention had wash walls or something like that. But the enduring memory is all my brothers and sisters that I get to go see once a year or stay in contact occasionally. Now that we have email, we can really stay in touch.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wholesome experience for me, and I might be still running the streets of North Dayton or be dead or be in jail.
Without it.
Without being admitted to the OS Nestle Home and literally saved my life.
Bob Impson, what about you? There's a million memories, but what's the overarching impression?
When I look back at my experience at the home, I have to think of all of the opportunities that we had later on in life. I left the trade that I had studied for in the home. Every child at age 12 had to pick a trade that they wished to follow. And I, using my ninth grade or my early education, I thought everybody's going to eat. I'm going to be their chef. And so I studied cooking. I can tell you that it took 36 pounds of butter just to butter the toast every morning for the children in the children's dining room. But I had a sister that studied cosmetology. My whole family, all the children raised at the home, were successful. I later left when the Army didn't use me for a mess sergeant. I ended up in education. It was very difficult because the vocational part of the program in the home took up a great deal of the academic time, and I had opportunities to participate. I won the state track high hurdles in 1941, but more importantly, I became the educator and the superintendent of schools, and I served in that capacity for 30 years. And I owe every bit of it to the home.
That is all the time we have for this segment. I want to thank Robert Impson of Cedarville. He graduated in 1941 from the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. He also is a former employee of the home, as he mentioned earlier, and has been actively involved with the Association of Ex-Pupils and the Rooney Foundation, the nonprofit foundation created to fund charitable projects to benefit ex-pupils of the home. Thanks again, Bob, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And also Morrison Gilbert. Morrison is from the class of 1956. He joins us now from Tombstone, Arizona. He also has been an active participant in the association and is a co-founder and major fundraiser for the Rooney Foundation. Maury, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And when we return, I also should say thanks to Ed Lentz.
Okay.
And if Ed can stay on for the next segment, much appreciated. Ed is the author of A Home of Their Own, The Story of Ohio's Greatest Orphanage. That's the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. When we return, we'll talk about the idea of an orphanage today, a modern-day orphanage. What would it be like, and what are the arguments for and against the concept? When we return, join us on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about women's rights and social activism on a global level with Miss Magazine co-founder, author, and social activist Gloria Steinem. Join us at 11 for All Sides with Ann Fisher. And in public radio, listener feedback is very important. We want to hear your thoughts on our radio programming, including what you think of All Sides with Ann Fisher. So NPR has partnered with WOSU, and we're creating an online audience advisory panel. We want you to be a part of it. All you have to do is go to WOSU.org/survey. Sign up and send us your thoughts. And it is 59 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high of 73. A few clouds tonight, a low of 48. Some sunshine for Friday and a high of 65. And looking ahead to Saturday, sunshine. There is a slight chance of rain and colder with a high of only 58. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've just concluded a discussion with former residents of the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home in Xenia, Ohio. The orphanage closed in the mid-1990s when such institutions went out of vogue in favor of foster care and other short-term group home setups. A lot of it had to do with economics as well, but the idea of returning to orphanages always has been out there. Staying with us right now, Ed Lentz, he wrote the book A Home of Their Own, the Story of Ohio's Greatest Orphanage. And as Ed mentioned earlier in the program, part of the book is about the conversation of returning to orphanages, or at least continuing them as an option in the, I guess, the matrix of how we manage our child care services in the United States. Joining us now is one such proponent of the institution, Richard McKenzie. Richard is an economist and professor at the University of California, Irvine. He is also the author of more than 25 books on economics. He has written a memoir as well about his life growing up in an orphanage. Richard is considered a national spokesman for the movement to develop modern-day orphanages. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Good to be with you, Ann.
We've just heard from two former students and residents of the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home. They loved it, no doubt, but a lot has changed since they grew up in the 1940s and the 1950s, respectively.
Yes.
How would that change be reflected in an orphanage today?
Well, the main problem with orphanages returning today is the cost of care, and the cost of care has gone up in large measure because of regulatory impositions on these homes. They can no longer take advantage of the economies of scale of congregate care to the extent that they did in the 1960s and before. And I guess another thing is the homes can no longer be self-sufficient. That is, my home, we had a farm and orchards, and we had chickens, cows, whatever, as I imagine the Ohio home also had. We worked on the farm and provided something to 85% of the funding, which means that in $2,010, dollars, the cost of care per child at Berrien Springs Home for Children was about $8,000. That includes education. Today, almost all of the work efforts that we did as children and teenagers has been outlawed. As a consequence, children don't have opportunities to develop work ethics, and they don't have opportunity to contribute to the cost of their care. And so those two areas have really increased the cost of care. And the opponents point to the cost of care as one reason not to go back to it. And I say, well, why not reconsider some of the rules and regulations and make these homes more viable? But the fact of the matter is that there are homes out there that exist that are doing extraordinarily well in spite of the obstacles that they have to face.
Why is it, what is it about the rules and regulations today that would prevent an orphanage from operating with the advantage of the economies of scale?
Well, I understand. Well, first off, when I went to my home at age 10, I went into Lee's Cottage, which had 24 kids for one house parent, and we slept 8 to a sleeping porch. That was the most congregate of congregate care, but when I became 12, we went to another dormitory or cottage where it was 2 kids per room, like a dorm room, and maybe 16 or 18 kids for the cottage. Same was true when I went to high school. Today, in North Carolina, I don't know about Ohio, but there's a rule that says that you must have one staff person per 6 children when they're asleep, and one staff person, one per 5 children when they're awake. And then again, these kids today are limited in what they can do by child labor laws, and they're also limited by liability rules. The Milton Hershey Home in Hershey, Pennsylvania, has an endowment. The last time I checked, it was over $8 billion. That's $1 billion. And they have to worry that if they assign a child a task and something goes wrong, some lawyer will be out there trying to tap into their considerable endowment.
Yeah, Bob Impson was talking in the last segment about all the trees they used to be able to climb, and I immediately thought, well, I don't know if you'd be able to climb those trees today.
I'm not sure that they would, but let me insist that if anybody doubts that an orphanage can be operated today at quality levels, I suggest that they go to the Cross North School in the mountains in North Carolina. They have 110 kids there. They have a school on campus. And it really is doing God's work.
Well, how do they manage when others can't? When you just explained the two big obstacles, why does this school succeed in spite of those?
I'm not exactly sure, other than the fact that they have the full support of the community. They have a lot of volunteer workers. They use sensible program guidelines, and they may skirt some things too, like at Crossnore. I remember Phyllis Crane, the executive director, who is a Mother Teresa of the United States, to tell me about how, well, if they got teenagers and they're in pretty good shape emotionally and behaviorally, then they will have 12 in the cottage. Younger kids, it's a smaller number. And they try to play the averages, and you can somehow figure on that. But they also have congregate eating facilities and so forth, which some homes try to avoid today. And, oh, they do, to the extent that they can push the limits of the law, they do have their children work. They have a shop there that makes mountain-type products that they sell to the public, and they do also things like have dogs in each of the cottage, and mm-hmm. and one of the health inspectors came in and said you can't have a dog in a cottage because there's food being left out, and Phyllis Crane said, well, how many points do I lose by having dog food left out? And by the way, you can have as much dog food left out in your home as you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, 2 or 3 points. She said, well, that's a good deal.
Yeah, the big jumping off, or the big change or change up is how we view an orphanage. They're not necessarily viewed as real homes anymore. And they're viewed as institutions.
And they're also viewed as temporary way stations.
Right.
They expect to bring a child in who may be difficult and try to engage in behavioral modification and then send them back to a bad situation after 3 or 4 months. And by the way, many homes that might be construed as an orphanage are really group homes, or these are homes for kids who have failed in the foster care system and done so maybe miserably at times, and have really behavioral difficulty. I know my home has converted from a children's home to such a group home arrangement, and those kids have to be monitored extraordinarily carefully. And many of the kids are there simply because they've gone from one placement to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, and the system itself has destroyed them. We have kids out there, I don't know what percentage, you can't get the numbers, but at least a third to a quarter of all foster care kids have been through multiple placements and multiple cycles through the system. It's not uncommon for kids to have 12 and 20 placements before they age out of the system. And it is rare, but still it happens, where kids have 40 and 50 placements before they go out of the system. Think about moving your child that many times in the course of a short childhood. Or think about what the speaker of the opening of the San Pascual Academy told the assembling audience there from the whole San Diego community. She said, the kids who come to this home are not going to have to experience what I had to experience. And that is, by the end of October of my freshman year in the foster care system, I had been through 8 high schools. To me, that's damnable. They just don't understand the importance of permanence, sense of permanence, sense of security, and also sense of home. Those things are extraordinarily important to children.
614-292-8513. We have a few minutes left to the conversation. If you'd like to join it, you can call that number or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Mike, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Just a comment and then a question. I think the idea of an orphanage is much better than sending people or children through so many different homes. And I would think it would take less people to supervise, and you could supervise on a much closer and even tone level than having to go out to all the different foster homes and worry about, you know, catching them in a bad time or something like that. Whereas in the orphanage, there's a camaraderie, there's empathy that within the children themselves, and they learn to depend on each other. It sounds like I think an orphanage would be better run under the right circumstances. But my question is, you were talking about there were 30 million people in America when the orphanage homes started. Now there's 300 million people in America. How many more orphanages would we need? And if just one bad story comes out of one orphanage, would that ruin it for all the orphanages?
Well, thanks, Mike. Yeah, I mean, the bad stories are what have ruined the image of orphanages. And a lot of the rules and regulations, Richard, came out of the bad stories, the bad experiences.
Oh, in fact, I heard all the bad stories up through my adult childhood and working as a professor, totally outside of child care. And I came to the conclusion that my home must have been special because we go back to homecoming every year to celebrate our childhood, not to commiserate with others about it. And so I started out an academic research project to find out exactly how did the orphanage alumni of the 1960s and before fare. And it turned out that they were the Lake Wobegons of the world. The orphans outpaced the general white population by wide margins on almost all social and economic measures, not the least of which are education, income, and attitude toward life. And the gaps are substantial. The 2,500 alumni that I surveyed had a 17% higher high school graduation rate, a 39% higher college graduation rate. I can't remember, but I think it's about 200% higher percentage of doctorates and MDs, and the income was significantly higher.
Back in the day, there weren't other options. That was pretty much the primary option was an orphanage. Now, good or bad, good, the bad, and the ugly, there are other options. Returning kids to their families as soon as possible, foster care system, group homes, and that kind of a thing. How do you decide what kid would get to go to an orphanage, and what would you tell that kid about why they're in the orphanage and why they don't get a shot at foster care or going back to their family?
Well, give the children a choice. They do it in Washington, D.C. under the SEED program, and families are engaging in lotteries just to get their kids in this quasi-orphanage. At the Cross North School, they give the kids, they show the kids around campus, and they ultimately have a decision to stay or not stay. And when they child welfare workers come in and say, we're going to put you back with your parents, give the kids some say-so in that kind of decisions, and allow the homes to take over any kind of state funding that may be coming in to serve the children. Too many times, the biggest complaint of directors of modern-day orphanages is that the child welfare system has the decision over whether when the child comes in and when the child leaves, and oftentimes they'll pull the child from these homes for financial reasons and stick them back into what is a problematic situation, where the child himself knows that it's going to be another round of failure.
Richard McKenzie, that is all the time we have for this segment. Richard McKenzie is a big proponent of the orphanage, returning to the orphanage option in the United States. He's written a memoir about his life growing up in an orphanage called The Home. Richard, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also Ed Lentz, thanks for sticking around. Ed is the author of A Home of Their Own, The Story of Ohio's Greatest Orphanage. Thanks for joining us today, Ed.
Always a pleasure, Ed.
That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.